Good afternoon. Bonjour et bienvenue à tout le monde. I'm Rebecca Fuhrer, and I have the privilege of being the chair of the Department of Epidemiology, Biostatistics, and Occupational Health, where we train both graduate students and clinicians in public health. It is now my pleasure to introduce our inaugural lecturer, Dr. Harvey Feinberg. Dr. Feinberg is president of the Institute of Medicine. He served as provost of Harvard University from 1997 to 2001, following 13 years as the dean of the Harvard School of Public Health. He has devoted most of his academic career to the fields of health policy and medical decision making, having both been trained as a clinician and has a doctorate in public policy. His past research has focused on the process of policy development and implementation, assessment of medical technologies, evaluation and use of vaccines, and dissemination of medical innovations. Dr. Feinberg helped found and served as president of the Society for Medical Decision-Making and has been a consultant to the World Health Organization. And among other roles, he has also served as the president of the Association of Schools of Public Health in the United States. Harvey has co-authored and co-edited many books on such diverse topics as clinical decision analysis, innovators in medical physician education, AIDS prevention, vaccine safety, and understanding risk in society. He earned his bachelor's and post and doctoral degrees from Harvard University. It is a pleasure to have Harvey join us today to talk about why prevention is a hard sell, otherwise, pourquoi la pilule de la prévention est difficile à avaler. Harvey is a colleague and friend of long date, and it's my pleasure that he has honored us with his visit for this inaugural lecture. Thank you, Harvey.
Change the program. Rebecca, thank you so very much for your generous introduction. I have to confess I'm quite relieved that Lord Strathcona's countenance is no longer peering down at me. His rather severe look makes this a much more serious enterprise than it might otherwise be, and I hope we'll have an opportunity to enjoy ourselves a little bit. I have to say I'm really thrilled to be here in Canada. We look at Canada today with great envy, with the prospect of global warming and climate change. Canada is supremely well positioned with land that will be usable for farming that today is not quite, and an environment that's going to be very comfortable for everyone. You've got as much oil you want to extract for as long as you want to extract it from the tar sands. And frankly, here in Quebec, you've got all the fresh water in the world, which is going to be the oil of the 21st century anyway. So really, the only mistake you've made is buying those condominiums in Florida, which, as far as I can tell, has been the only misjudgment in recent days of Canada. So I'm thrilled. I'm also delighted to be the inaugural lecturer in this program that Dr. Fuhrer has put into place, and to be here with such a good friend and with others that I've come to know and admire is a great pleasure as well. Rebecca's brilliant translation of this title puts me in mind of the story of James Thurber, when he was the American humorist who actually loved visiting the continent. And on one of his visits to Paris, a woman came up to him at a cocktail party and was going on and on about how wonderful his writing was, how funny he was. And she said, "You know, Mr. Thurber, it's even funnier in the French translation." And he looked at her and he said, "Yes, it loses something in the original." So I'm thinking, well, this may lose something in the original, but bear with me. I hope that we'll have an opportunity to reflect today on the idea of prevention, the ideal of prevention of disease, which is, after all, such a well-established cultural norm in society and in life. I mean, the saying, "A stitch in time saves nine," or "An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure." I mean, we know these from childhood. We understand the principles. And even more than just knowing the ideas of prevention, if we look honestly back at the 20th century experience in health in countries around the globe, it's very clear that prevention played a critical role in progress. In fact, if you think, what's the 20th century going to be remembered for in historical perspective, 200, 300, 400 years from now, the century of flight, of space exploration, the century of the computer, the century of the atom, all those are very valid, but I think there's a good chance that it's also going to be remembered as the century of disease prevention and of advancement in life expectancy. In the space of 100 years of the 20th century, life expectancy at birth in countries like the United States increased by more than 25 years. If you think about that, it means that every year on average, life expectancy at birth increased by 3 months. Now, that is about the best argument for contraception that I have ever heard, because if you just delay having the baby another year, the baby is born with 3 months more of life expectancy. What could be a bigger gift that you could give to your yet unborn child? But the point is that if you examine what's behind this extraordinary progress, with one rather dramatic exception in the early phase, you all know what that was? Flu. That was flu, the great flu pandemic. But except for that blip and that period which set back the progress, the century is a century of progress. And it's a century of progress which is dependent mostly on, in the first half of the century, introduction of sanitation, introduction of eventually antimicrobials toward the middle part of the century, vaccines that prevent the diseases of childhood and preventing deaths of children have a great amplifying effect on advancement in life expectancy. Later in the century, treatment does come in to begin to play a stronger effect, but the ideas of prevention carry throughout. And with all of this evidence and with the cultural soundness and familiarity of the ideas of prevention, you might well ask yourself, well, why is it that prevention isn't even more popular in practice as it is in folklore? Why do we not do as much as we could to prevent disease? And I want to share with you some thoughts today on some of the reasons, as I see it, that make prevention a difficult idea to put into practice, and think with you a little bit about some of the ways we might counteract some of these reasons. So let's begin. First, I want to just characterize briefly some distinctions between a preventive approach and a therapeutic or treatment approach in care for patients. Essentially, in a curative approach, we're looking to identify what it is we want to treat, whereas in prevention, we're thinking about what is the risk we can reduce. From a curative approach, we're thinking about restoring health and return to what we think of as the norm for the individual. In prevention, we're thinking about reducing risk that shifts the norm of expectation about the likelihood of disease. In a curative approach, there's predominantly a personal service ethic that's behind it, taking care of individuals one at a time. In a preventative approach, there's much greater sense of a responsibility for the health of a whole population in addition to individuals. And in a curative strategy, most of what we do is in a clinical context. Whereas if you have a preventive mindset, it's true we do some things in the clinical interaction of nurses, physicians, and other health professionals with individual patients, but much more we are dealing also with changes in the lifestyle, the environment, and other determinants of risk for the development of disease. So we're looking at behavioral and social as well as clinical interventions. The first and fundamental reason why prevention is difficult as an idea is that when it succeeds, it's invisible. That's the whole idea of prevention. How many of us, for example, know, as if we are middle-aged or older, that we have not had a heart attack because we have either not chosen to smoke or quit smoking, or we think we have a better diet and exercise? How many of us can know that that's why we have been free of a heart attack? The answer is none of us can know, because we can never be sure whether the change that has affected people generally actually applies to us personally. And when prevention works, it's a non-event. We don't count non-events. And so it's like the background of the figures you're looking at. To appreciate prevention, you have to be able, in a gestalt sense, to make the background the foreground. You have to be able to see the absence of events as what is worth noticing. It's like the Sherlock Holmes story, where the important clue was the dog that did not bark in the night. Prevention is invisible when it succeeds. There's also a lack of drama with prevention. I mean, when you have a case in the tertiary care hospital of the surgeon who is transplanting a liver into an infant who had biliary atresia and would otherwise die, this is a very dramatic achievement. And we celebrate that success. We're thrilled for the infant, for the family. We rightly celebrate the surgeon. But have we given any thought to the child who died in the automobile accident, whose liver became available because that child's parents didn't put the child in a proper car seat at the time they were on their drive? Do we think, in other words, about the undramatic side of what makes prevention just as precious in saving the life of the child who would not die as it is in curative care to retrieve the life of the child who would otherwise die? But prevention generally lacks drama. A third problem with prevention is that it deals with statistical lives. It deals with average changes in the population. It's the counterpoint to the invisibility. I don't know if some of you may remember a couple of years ago, really more than a decade now, when there was a story in the United States. I can't believe it wasn't also broadcast in Canada. It was all over the United States about a little baby baby Jessica, who had fallen into a well in Texas. Do you remember that story? Well, everybody remembers this story because every channel of every television had their cameras glued on this well, and the firemen were there, and it took more than 2 days. It was 58 hours before they were able to extract this baby from the well, and what a huge relief it created in the entire country. The entire population celebrated the saving of baby Jessica. And yet, every day, children just like baby Jessica are just as caught in poverty, in disadvantaged circumstance, equally as life-threatening, equally determining the shortness of their lives, and we don't think about them because they're just going to be statistics. They're not an identifiable individual. Remember that a health statistic is a number with a tier attached to it. And we have to be able to translate statistical lives into meaningful emotional events if we're going to make prevention salient for people. Fourth problem with prevention is it takes a long time before the benefits actually accrue. So you're going to tell me that I got to lose 10 pounds, exercise every day, quit smoking, cut down on my drinking, and what, I might get some benefit in 30 or 40 years? Well, in my case, 10 or 20, but I mean, for some of you, 30 or 40? That's a hard sell. That means you've got to be able to look over a lifetime and think about prevention of the things that matter to people nearer as well as farther away, the things that truly threaten each stage of life. And a lot of the threats in younger people actually are things we also don't think about as often, even in health prevention, which is emotional and behavioral life and the risk of depression and suicide. That's what is threatening to young people beyond injury and unintended injury, self-inflicted and unintended injury. So we need to both make it relevant to people now, but we have to also think about what is it that is convincing to individuals whose lives are difficult day in and day out to be able nevertheless to think about something in the far-off future. I don't know if you're familiar with the experiment, the very famous experiment with four-year-old children, in which they're seated at a little table in a room, and the experimenter puts a marshmallow in front of them. And the four-year-old is told, if you can wait for 5 minutes, I'm going to go out of the room without eating this marshmallow, I'll give you a second marshmallow also. And then the experimenter walks out of the room. There's, of course, a one-way window in the filming of the children, and they are the funniest things to watch. They're squirming all over the place. The ones who succeed in not eating the marshmallow have purposely distracted themselves doing other things. And what's most interesting about this experiment is that when they go back years later to look at the follow-up of the children, it turns out those children who are capable of delayed gratification are much more likely to be healthier and to do well in school than those children who are unable to wait at age 4 for 5 minutes before eating the marshmallow. So whether this is something we can actually teach children or if it's a temperamental reality even from an early age is a question that I leave open. Maybe we can discuss. Here's a problem very fundamental to prevention. The person who's willing to invest in prevention or the institution that's willing to invest in it may not be the one that's actually going to get the benefits. Let me put you in the frame of mind of a board of a hospital. Let's suppose we were all sitting, instead of in this very comfortable room, around a board table in a hospital. We're responsible for the hospital. And one of the nurses and doctor teams comes in to present to the board a new proposal for a community-based program for diabetes prevention and care. And their proposal is that the hospital put in place a series of community-based health workers with nursing backup reporting into supervisory physicians for monitoring in the home the patients with diabetes for early and rapid detection of any deviation from their management and any difficulties that are developing. And they bring you evidence that in other pilot studies that have been done, such community-based activity programs have been shown at the cost of only $2,000 per patient per year to reduce hospitalization by 50%. So what they want is for the hospital to underwrite $50,000 to do an initial pilot with 25 patients. Sounds pretty good so far. But what is the hospital actually being asked to do? It's being asked to reduce its patient load because 50% of the patients who previously were hospitalized are not going to come in. It's being asked to put out $50,000 of money that it otherwise could use for any number of critical equipment and other needs that the hospitals always have. And soon enough, I can be sure that someone is going to raise the question on our board as to whether it's really our responsibility to reach out in that way, and is it not an intrusion in the privacy of people to go into their homes and to manage their care? We'll come up with a lot of reasons why it's really not either advisable or our responsibility to do it. And part of the problem here is that we have a misalignment of who's paying and who's benefiting. And this is a very large generic problem in healthcare broadly, but it especially expresses itself in the case of a lot of preventive opportunities. Okay, now let's look a little bit in the mirror ourselves. How consistently do health professionals and public health leaders put forward guidance and advice to patients? The answer we'd like to say, well, we can be pretty consistent on some things. I think it's pretty unlikely that anyone is going to come forward to explain why cigarette smoking and tobacco actually is a healthful thing to do. But what about mammography at age 40? Well, we just went through an episode in the United States where the Preventive Services Task Force relooked at the evidence and said, you know, when you're between age 40 and 50, if you're a woman of average or low risk, that is, without a family history, the false positives, the follow-up testing, and the invasive testing of biopsy is offsetting any benefit that would be accrued from earlier detection, and in fact came back with a recommendation that said, if you're age 40 to 50, you should be not considering this automatically. It should be based on an individualized assessment with your physician, which in turn was translated in the U.S. as an effort to begin to ration healthcare, which of course is a very negative thing in any health system, but particularly under a U.S. Spend whatever it takes model for health intervention. And we have to ask ourselves, well, how do we expect people to follow what we recommend if they can look back on case after case and say, well, you used to tell us this and now you're telling us that? How soon is it going to be? You know that Woody Allen film in which he emerges from a time capsule and they're talking about the next meal. I mean, he's starving and he says, oh, I won't have the steak or the eggs. And they look at each other, puzzled. Oh, they say, yes, the 20th century. That's when we thought steak and cholesterol were bad for you. And, you know, we always say in medicine, we know half of what we believe is wrong. We just aren't sure yet which half it's going to be. So this is a real challenge that we have to be able to express our confidence accurately and persuasively. And how do you do that when, in fact, the level of evidence is enough to convince you that it's the right thing to do, but you believe is not really enough to convince a skeptic? And so how do you then, as a health professional, convey the information? Do you overstate it in order to get the result that you believe in your heart is the actually correct result? Or do you accurately portray it in a way that you're ready to recognize is not necessarily going to persuade the skeptic that what you believe is right should be done? So thinking hard about guidance is a really important challenge for making prevention work. We've kind of hinted at this already. For prevention to work, it's not like a one-time thing. That same patient who's told, you know, to lose 20 pounds and cut down on the drinking, quit smoking, get regular exercise, may well be thinking, you know, can't you operate? I mean, it would just be one thing. I'd be done with it. Instead, no, we're telling you this is about your life. This is how you live. This is every day. This is the new you. And so prevention to work means that you're going to have to be doing things persistently over a sustained period of time. Now, I want to ask you another supposition, but I want to put you in the mind of being the head of, really the czar, I mean in charge of everything, on an island in a Pacific archipelago. You are the chief. And it turns out that there's an outbreak of the avian influenza. This H5N1 influenza has finally figured out how to spread among humans, and it's working its way from island to island on the archipelago. And you're right in line, just a couple away from you. Everywhere that this epidemic has struck, it has killed half the people who are infected. And it's infected almost everyone. That means on these islands where it has already occurred, half the people have died from it. Are you with me so far? Okay, now, turns out a vaccine had been developed against this particular strain. It's been tested, and it's remarkable in that it works perfectly. It's 100% protective. However, the cost of that 100% protection is it also produces 25% mortality. So it's a really dangerous but highly effective vaccine. 25% die from the vaccine, but it works for the others. Everybody with me on the premise? Okay, now the question. Think to yourself. Don't look to your partner. You're the one in charge. Personally, you're the chief. How many of you would deploy the vaccine to protect the people on your island? Raise your hands. Almost, okay. How many would not deploy the vaccine? It's about, I would say a few more in this group would deploy it, but would not. Okay, for those who would deploy it, what if I said the vaccine kills 40%? How many would still deploy it? One, two, a handful. If I said 49%? Okay, someone would, okay. For those of you who wouldn't deploy the vaccine, what if it would only kill 10%? How many now would deploy it? That's over the threshold. What is the point of this? Well, here's the real point. Oh, you know what? I got it just backwards. It's the virus that kills 25% and the vaccine that kills 50%. How many people are going to use that vaccine? Nobody's going to use that vaccine. Now, why is the first question hard and the second question obvious? I would submit that one of the key differences is that we do not, most of us, with maybe one or two exceptions, most of us do not feel the same about a natural event that happens without our active intervention and bad things occur compared to an error of commission where we commit the action that produces the bad event. We just don't feel symmetrically, most of us, about errors of omission and errors of commission. We would rather let natural things happen. And if you need to intervene with prevention in a population where otherwise just natural things will happen, well, you're already working uphill against the natural reluctance to make errors that are a result of commission more than reluctant to make errors as a result of omission. Now, you could ask yourself, well, that's how I behave. That's an accurate description of what I prefer when I'm just asked, but is that how I want to behave? Should I be making an adjustment in that way? And that's a question maybe we'll come back to discuss a little bit later. But the bias against errors of commission is a real additional hardship for prevention. Now, every day if you pick up a newspaper, certainly in the United States, you read about some local horrible thing that's happened. Usually in the U.S. somebody shoots somebody. You know the difference between an American and a Canadian is that a Canadian is an unarmed American with health insurance. Actually, you've got almost as many firearms. You just don't have the custom of shooting each other as often as we do in the U.S. So you read about this all the time in the U.S. So in the U.S., it's almost like it just happens. People occasionally shoot each other. Like people occasionally die on the highway. Accidents happen. Sweden decided, no, the norm is not that accidents happen on the highway. The norm should be zero highway deaths. And in the year 2005, Sweden achieved the lowest rate of fatalities on the highway in two decades, where the United States that particular year had a spike had the highest rate in more than a decade. So thinking about the, quote, normal as truly avoidable is an important part of making prevention work. It's recognizing that sometimes avoidable harm that we just don't think about, we should. Now, when I say we've introduced a new and improved treatment for a disease, the question that I'm asked is, can you prove that it is technically superior to the existing treatment? Does it save more lives? Does it reduce morbidity? And if I'm in a systems way of thinking, I might be asked, and does it save lives at a cost that is worthwhile? Do we add value to our system by having this expenditure for that amount of gain? We know it's going to cost us more money, but is that worth the additional lives that we save and the quality of life that we introduce? That's what we do with treatments. Oftentimes with a preventive, the question is, did it save money as well as lives? We're spoiled in a way with vaccines. Assessments of childhood vaccines in the United States suggest that for every $1 expended on vaccines, society realizes $5 of return in terms of reduced treatment costs, in terms of increased work, not just in the child but in the parents, in indirect savings that follow from this. So it does produce net savings, but that's a hyper standard, and it's a different standard than we normally apply to treatments. Nobody ever asks if a new surgery is going to save money. We ask if it saves lives at a reasonable cost. And the fact that we are accustomed to thinking about prevention in a way that is a harder standard to achieve makes it a harder sell in policy terms. Well, this is pretty obvious. Conflicts with commercial interests. That is former President Reagan in an earlier incarnation. This is not a slide that's just been composed on Photoshop. This is a real poster that Chesterfield promoted its cigarettes for Christmas holiday. It was the same era when doctors were promoting cigarettes because they caused fewer coughs after they had figured out how to get the alkali down in tobacco while manufacturing and so on. So it came out of a certain era. But, you know, it was not that long ago in the U.S., in the mid-1990s, when in front of the Congress, a row of executives from tobacco companies each testified under oath that tobacco, to the best of their knowledge, was not addictive. They said that one after another. Now, maybe knowing, as I do, about the psychology of belief and understanding, maybe they were being sincere. But the fact that we have commercially grounded interests who can, with a straight face, deny the addictive properties of a dangerous substance means that we've got sometimes a lot of commercial obstacles to overcome in trying to promote better health. A contemporary example in the United States is that no local jurisdiction in the United States to date, to the best of my knowledge, has yet successfully introduced a tax on sugary soft drinks. Not one. It's been defeated everywhere that it's been proposed. And it's been defeated because there's been a lot of money put into explaining to people why this is an infringement on their God-given right to harm themselves. And then, of course, conflicts with deeply felt personal, religious, ideological beliefs. This is another important obstacle for prevention. You could say, well, these are not necessarily bad obstacles. This is just the way people are. There are strong religious convictions about contraception. When the Institute of Medicine recommended to the Secretary of Health and Human Services, when asked about provisions of prevention for women especially, that should be included under the U.S. Affordable Care Act, and the committee recommended contraceptive services as ones to be covered, and the Secretary adopted that, well, we still haven't heard the end of it in the U.S. It's still playing out, including most recently a lawsuit which has been brought by a number of Catholic institutions in the United States who are protesting the requirement that they make available through insurance these services. Not that they provide them directly, but just that they include that coverage for their employees. So this is going to play out, that specific case, in the U.S. in the coming months and years. But in general, we have groups who, like this child apparently, believe that you can go on motorcycles without helmets, and that's free. I don't know, what is it in the province? Do you have to wear a helmet here? Okay. How about on bicycles? Do people do that also? Is that a law, or is that just not a law? Okay. Well, this is a quick dozen, and so that we don't just end on problems, I'd like to suggest certain ways that we can help to overcome a number of these obstacles that all together add up. You wonder, how do we get any preventive accomplished? The first important lesson is that when it comes to preventive services, we should pay for them. We should not require individuals to pay for proven preventive services. Lower the obstacle for financial reluctance to participate. But even more than that, for certain preventives, we should be making them cheaper than free, which I mean we should be rewarding people. There's a wonderful part of the program of Seguro Popular in Mexico, which is their health insurance scheme, which actually compensates families for undertaking the immunization of their children, so that they make it not just free to the families, but actually cheaper than free. They pay. They are compensated for doing that. The workplace is an underutilized resource for prevention. And a reason that it's a potentially valuable resource is that there is a case where the beneficiary and the payer can be conjoined. Because the benefits of prevention, which of course accrue to the individual, also accrue to the employer, who gets a healthier workforce, a more engaged workforce. Instead of absenteeism, there's this problem called presenteeism, in which you're there but just not really working. And you reduce that very dramatically also by active programs for prevention. So involving employers is a strategy that we can use. We can also figure out ways to make it simpler, easier, cheaper for people to do the right thing. Seatbelts were great, but airbags made it even easier, because seatbelts and airbags together are more protective. The airbag didn't require the person even to reach over their shoulder and pull the strap down. And the less you can require people to do through engineering and through redesign to make things safer, to make things more predictably healthy, that can be a way that we can overcome some of the obstacles. And then we have to recognize that these obstacles are serious and challenging. And if we're in the business of health, which many of us are, we have to be prepared to educate, repeat, be persistent, change the framing of the questions and the options for people so it is more understandable and more acceptable. You know, as a researcher, and I think maybe for many of you trained in research methods, we're actually conditioned to be very wary of individual stories. And particularly, we say the plural of anecdote is not evidence, right? They're just stories. You haven't got a design that gives you reliable information. And what we have to be able to do, I would submit, is to couple that scientific approach and objective assessment of evidence with a capacity and willingness to communicate the results of those studies in ways that can be vivid, individualized, and engaging for people. And that often means stories of individuals. So we need to be able simultaneously, if our goal is to promote health and prevention of disease, we have to be willing to take the evidence which is gained by excluding anecdotes, convert it into a form that is digestible, understandable, and meaningful to people. And that is a big challenge. And finally, we're always going to depend on leaders of political structures, of institutional structures, of professional structures, who are willing to make the right policy choices to get things done. And the important lesson here is it really can succeed. And I want to just show you another set of figures as compared to what I started with. This is life expectancy change from 1987 to 2009 in New York City. There was an assessment done by the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington of life expectancy by county and city in the United States. New York City, each of the boroughs actually counts as a county. So those five boroughs were five of the units entered into the database of 3,147 counties and cities in the United States and their life expectancy changes over a period of time. The number one improvement was Manhattan. The number one improvement in the period of time covered, a 10-year period, it was a growth of 10 years in life expectancy from, it's more than 10 years, from 1990 approximately to 2009, 19 years, but a 10-year improvement. That was the first in the nation. And all of the five boroughs, in terms of improvement, ranked in the top percentile. Now, was that an accident? I would submit it was no accident of history. It was because of policies taken by a mayor and a city council and at the advice of a health commissioner who first was Tom Frieden, who is now the Center for Disease Control director, and in more recent years, Tom Farley, the health commissioner of New York City, and the mayor through this period, Michael Bloomberg. Tom Frieden tells the story when he went into talk to the mayor about the idea of eliminating smoking in public places. And he was prepared with a lot of evidence. And particularly he was concerned about smoking in restaurants because people were saying, oh, New Yorkers are going to go to New Jersey to eat. You know, you're going to lose business. And people are going to hate this. And this is going to be very unpopular. And so he had a lot of arguments ready. And he went into the mayor and he said, Mr. Mayor, we've come to the conclusion that we want to ban smoking in public establishments, particularly in restaurants and bars. And the story is that the mayor turned to him and asked him one question. He said, are you sure this will save lives? And Frieden said, yes, we are. And the mayor said, then do it. At which point, Tom Frieden began to explain why it was really complicated and that there's going to be a lot of opposition and that there was going to be trouble and people are even saying that diners are going to go to New Jersey. And he was going on like this, and the mayor put up his hand and said, the first lesson in salesmanship is that when you make the sale, leave. And so I want to leave you with the lesson of Mayor Bloomberg. When we do succeed, it's a good time to stop. Thank you all very much for your attention.